desire to create is one of the deepest yearnings of the human soul. We each have an inherent wish to create something that did not exist before. The more you trust and rely upon the Spirit, the greater your capacity to create.
I'm Nancy Hansen, and this is Everything Creative. This program explores a wide range of creative ideas, talents, and experiences through interviews and group discussions. Today, musician and luthier Craig Miner interviews architect Curtis Miner.
Well, this is Craig Miner, and today I'll be interviewing my brother, Curtis Miner, who is an architect, and he has a firm in Pleasant Grove called Curtis Miner Architecture. Let's just get started by having you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit more about who you are.
Okay. Curtis Miner is my name, and architecture is what I do. My wife and I run a firm that's about 10 years old, and it's located in Pleasant Grove, was previously in Orem, and we do mostly commercial buildings. Most often it's office and retail, some other types of buildings, light industrial, a lot of multifamily housing, and the firm right now is made up of 14 people. We've got two other licensed architects, as well as a number of technical staff and secretarial people.
We should let people know, I actually was privileged to be a part of the ground floor operation of Curtis Miner Architecture when it was actually in your basement in Springville. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I had worked for another firm for a number of years, and when it was time to go on my own, I worked alone for a while, just in our basement. And when we got busy enough that I needed drafting help, I asked Craig if he had ever done drafting, CAD drafting. He said no. I said, well, how would you like to learn? So we got together, and I kind of showed him some of the basics. And from there, he worked for about a year, and then off and on for the next couple of years, helping us out and getting through crunch times and things like that.
So, yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. We'll talk more about architecture as we talk today, but I'm curious in what other ways do you think of yourself as being creative? Like, do you have any other hobbies or things that you do that are creative in nature? I can think of a couple.
Maybe you should help me out.
Well, as a kid growing up, and even to this day, I know that you spend a lot of time building model airplanes and flying model airplanes. And maybe you could talk about that. And also the fact that you play music like me. You're a musician, and in fact, we played in a band together. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that, too.
Okay. Well, let's start with the music. First off, I am an aspiring musician, but nothing like Craig. Craig's taken it way beyond where I ever have been. But, yeah, we did start out playing music together, and that's actually where I met my wife, is in a group that Craig was involved in. I guess my recollection of how Craig got his start in music is we had a group that we had put together based on some friendships at high school, and they would end up coming to practice at our house once in a while, and Craig would kind of sit off in the corner, not say anything, but just kind of listen. And then when everyone would leave, he'd pick up one of my dad's guitars and start figuring things out. And before long, he was in the band, and before long, he was leading the band. And shortly after that, he went well beyond the rest of us and made it, you know, his profession. So as far as the model airplanes go, that started with Dad was he grew up during World War II. And he lived at the end of a runway in California where they would land some of the World War II planes. And so as a result of that, he became interested in airplanes and ended up building plastic models. As we were growing up, he would do a few of those. And as I became interested in that, you know, and instead of building plastic models, I ended up building some that could actually fly, some balsa wood and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the thing that was interesting to me about that, and still is, I'm still involved in that, was it's kind of a technical process to make it through a model design and construction, work out all the details of how the thing works. But then there's something artistic about how a plane takes flight, particularly gliders, sailplanes. That's kind of where most of my interest is. And I don't know, there's just something really elegant about a glider, particularly in flight, and mm-hmm. Working in conjunction with nature to try and stay aloft and things like that. So,
is it always, obviously there's always a first time you throw your glider off of a cliff on which you've spent hundreds of hours.
Right.
Is that always a harrowing experience, a little nerve-wracking?
Yeah, it is. It's most often, if you've done your homework, it goes well. Sometimes it doesn't go so well.
I remember a story when we had a competition, a gliding competition down in Arizona or something.
Oh, yeah.
It actually had a bad ending.
Right.
Tell us briefly about that story. I think that would be interesting.
Okay. Well, in the world of model airplanes, there's kind of a national group of people that compete on that level, on a national level. And the format for these contests is it's a two-day contest, and they're normally held on Saturday and Sunday. Well, I had never flown on Sunday before. I didn't feel it was appropriate. And on this one occasion, I was really excited about flying at the time and decided that I would go down and participate in this contest in Arizona on Saturday and Sunday. And so we got down there after, you know, a lot of preparation and work and the flight and the drive and finally show up at the field and the contest starts. First flight, I launched the glider, and I don't honestly to this day know what happened, but there was some sort of a radio problem. And one of the flaps dropped and the glider just spun in all the way to the ground, landed on a motorhome, made a big dent in the motorhome, completely destroyed the glider, and I sat on the bench watching everyone else for the next 2 days. So learned my lesson.
So you never actually flew on Sunday?
I never did fly on Sunday during that contest, and I've never flown on Sunday since, or been tempted.
somebody was making sure you didn't, apparently.
Apparently, right.
Wow, that's funny. In retrospect, it's funny. I'm sure it was very hard to watch your baby go down.
Yeah, well, it happens.
All right, well, let's get back to the architecture thing. Tell us, I guess, briefly about your journey in architecture. Where did you get started? What piqued your interest, and what is your path to where you are now in the field of architecture?
Okay. I guess it kind of starts when I was young. I spent a lot of time. My two main interests could be kind of categorized in two areas. The first one would be kind of the artistic side, and the second one would be the more technical side. So going through school, I really enjoyed art classes, and I enjoyed, you know, learning about art history and things like that. But I also enjoyed things like math and calculus and physics. And then another little thing that kind of plays into it later, as part of the exploration of art, I kind of got into a drafting class. And I happened to get into a class that was taught by a very well-respected and very knowledgeable teacher. And he kind of recognized in me a capability of doing that type of drawing, as well as the other more artistic type drawings. And so as I made it through high school, I really didn't know what I wanted to do because I was thinking that at some point I'm going to have to make a decision to kind of leave the artistic side and focus on the technical, or leave the technical side and focus on the artistic. And that dilemma was going on all the way through college, all the way into my junior year. And so out of high school, because I had some background in drafting, I just naturally went into drafting at UVSC at the time, now UVU. And they have a great program over there, and I spent some time in some classes and actually ended up getting hired by a company out of that program and spent time before my mission working for that company. And then after I got back, I actually just jumped right back into that field and kept going in drafting, thinking all the time that drafting was simply a way to get me through college, and then in college I'd decide what I really wanted to do and do it. Hmm. Well, after spending time at UVSC, I went to BYU, and I honestly don't remember what prompted this, but I ended up taking a kind of an aptitude test. And in that aptitude test, there was a series of questions, and I didn't see where it was going during the test itself. But after the test, when we started reviewing the results, the person that I was working with pointed out that, you know, you're very strong technically, you're very strong artistically, and the people that have those capabilities do very well in architecture. And I had never really thought of that before, but as I got thinking about it, I got excited about it, and then I started looking into it further and found out that architecture is really a very natural combination, a very good combination of both sides, of the technical side and of the artistic side.
Yeah. In fact, I'm thinking, sitting here thinking, what other areas would there be that combine so evenly the artistic and the mechanical side of things?
Not many.
I can't think of many.
No, even the engineers that we work with, they're very much focused on the technical part of it, and they're necessary to design a building. But, you know, with a few exceptions, most of them are very technically minded and kind of struggle on the artistic side. And then alternatively, if we've got people that we work with sometimes that are very good on the artistic side but really don't have the technical capability, and so they've got to, you know, team themselves with others that have that capability.
Right.
So anyway, yeah.
Interesting. Okay. So from there, then, you decided to maybe pursue architecture. How did it pursue from that point until you are today, where you head up your own firm?
Well, the first step after I got excited about architecture and basically made the decision that that was what I was going to do, BYU actually doesn't offer a program that prepares you to become licensed as an architect. And so I immediately had to switch to another school, happened to be the University of Utah. Mm-hmm. And they've got a good program up there that is accredited, which, without getting into all the detail, it basically allows you to become licensed as an architect. So transferred up there and started taking the classes and enjoyed that experience. Architecture school is difficult. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of work that goes into it. There are a lot of late nights. There are a lot of things that happen in any program like that, that where you're working on a graduate level where mm-hmm. they really push you, and it's really a challenge to try and help you learn what it is you need to learn in the real world.
Yeah.
So after a number of years, made it through that program. And one of the requirements to become licensed as an architect is that you need to work under the direct supervision of another licensed architect. And so I ended up working for Steve Sandstrom. Mm-hmm. And he has a firm in Orem, and was a great experience. He was very good at what he did, and he taught me a lot of things about the field. And so I enjoyed my time there. And as we got to the end of the three-year internship time, I kind of had to make a decision as to where, if I wanted to invest my future in his firm, or if I wanted to try something on my own. Mm. And due to a number of circumstances, probably the largest of which is the American Heritage School that we designed, and I'll probably talk about that a little bit later. But okay. Because of a number of circumstances, I ended up going off on my own right at that three-year mark, just shortly after I had been licensed. Mm-hmm. Talking with Janine, my wife, the thinking was that, you know, at some point in the future, we wanted to own our own firm. Mm-hmm. And we thought that, you know, we could either do that right now, right out of school and right after the internship, and if it works, great. In 10 years, we've got 10 years of history with a firm. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't, I can always go get another job.
Right.
And so that was our logic
yeah.
at the time of jumping off on our own. But it's worked out, and we've grown, you know, me in my basement with Craig initially, and then we moved into a building, and we've just slowly added people to the firm till now we have 14. We were at 18 a few months ago, and we've had one go on a mission, a couple go back to school. So. Mm-hmm. We've downsized, but we hadn't laid anybody off, which
okay.
is good.
Okay, so involuntary downsizing.
There you go.
Maybe you could tell us about maybe a certain project that you've done as an architect, and tell us about that, and maybe if there's something you can think of that has some sort of, you know, personal connection to you, something you feel really vested in that has been built. Maybe tell us about that and the whole process and how that works.
Okay. The first one that comes to mind is that American Heritage School that I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. That actually was the first project we did as a company, as a firm, but we've continued to be involved in a number of different ways in the school from the time it was designed and built until now. So that project, maybe a little bit of background on it. The school itself was started as kind of a private religious-based school. It started in a small church in Pleasant Grove and was there for a number of years until it got to where it needed to grow into a larger building. And so I was one of three architects asked to prepare design ideas for the board of directors. Hmm. And the ideas were selected, and we were able to complete the project. The interesting thing about the project is the property that they were able to secure to build the project is actually directly across the street from the Mount Timpanogos Temple in American Fork. And the school is kind of founded on religious principles, and they do very well academically, but they also incorporate moral or religious education into the classroom. Hmm. Architecturally, it was a really neat opportunity to kind of take some of the ideals and principles that are displayed in the temple through the construction of the temple and to try and reference them and incorporate them and try and connect them to the school building, which was across the street. In the design of the building, to describe the property a little bit, it kind of sits up on a hill, and the property is right along the brow of the same hill that the temple is on, and it has a beautiful view of the valley from that property. Hmm. And also it has a view of the temple, of course, and they're kind of right there together. The two views are kind of side by side. And so in thinking about how the people would use this building over the course of a day, the students and the teachers and others, I felt like it was important to connect those people in the building to the symbol of the temple. The temple being something that symbolizes what they were on the core, mm-hmm. you know, their foundational principles and things. And so where normally a school is arranged in a double-loaded corridor, meaning, you know, you have classrooms on either side of a single corridor, mm-hmm. what we did on this one is arrange the building in a pod configuration and use the large hallway that connects all of these classroom pods, a pod having six classrooms in it.
Okay.
There's a large hallway that connects the classroom pods. It is glass on one side, and it's situated on the side of the property that faces the temple. So as you move through this building throughout the day, you're always kind of referencing this temple. It's always visible, regardless of where you are in the building.
That's interesting.
You know, the pods have a hallway that goes down between the six classrooms, three on either side. And as you come out of that pod, there's also kind of a framed big piece of glass that has a door in it that actually focuses right on the temple again. So it's just the idea there is that as you move throughout this building through the day, you're constantly reminded of the principles that are at the foundation of the school.
Interesting.
And there are some other things in the school that are kind of the same idea. There's a faculty library. Part of the direction that we got from the owner was that they needed to have a faculty library that was apart from the student library.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a boardroom as part of what they wanted to do. And we got thinking that from a philosophical standpoint, the faculty library is something where kind of education starts there with the teachers, and then it's kind of disseminated into the students.
Hmm.
And so the way that was expressed in the building is the faculty library is actually above a large rotunda in the middle of the building, and that rotunda is where all of the different hallways converge. It all comes to a center point.
Okay, and then the faculty library is just above that.
Just directly above it. And going through the faculty library is this big, you know, massive skylight shaft. And so if you stand at that center point of the building and kind of look off in all directions to see these hallways, I think there are four of them that come together, directly above you is a big skylight. And then as you were go up that shaft to get to the skylight, you actually would go through the faculty library. So symbolically what's happening there is we're kind of referencing the source of all truth and knowledge, God, coming down through the faculty library, in other words, educating them, and then going to the center of where everything converges in the building, and then being distributed out to the students.
That's very interesting.
One final thing, the boardroom was actually positioned right over the main entry on the front of the building, directly across from the temple. So the concept there was the board of directors is they're the body that kind of sets the direction for the long-term goals and things of the school and decides on how the school is going to respond to its founding principles. And so we wanted to put the board, while they're deliberating, having those discussions and making those decisions, we wanted to put them in the prime spot that is directly related to the temple so that, again, they're reminded of where this whole thing started. And, you know, if there's a temptation to stray, and they, just their environment will try and encourage them to stay with the foundation of the school.
Okay. I wanted to just ask you if you feel like you have anything to say about church architecture, for example, you know, other temples or some of the other church buildings or early temples or anything like that. Do you have anything that you know about them as an architect that might be enlightening to those of us who don't know much about architecture?
Well, we got a chance to go through the Kirtland Temple a number of years ago, and a number of things struck me about the temple, but one in particular was if you compare it to the temples that we use today, the modern temples that have been built in the last 10, 20 years, the inside of the temple is completely different. It was the program on it was different. And I should explain that the program in the world of architecture is the list of rooms and how those rooms are associated with each other and connected and related. And basically, it's what the building is supposed to do, what its function is. In the Kirtland Temple, I was surprised when we walked in to find what looked more like a chapel than, you know, what you'd normally see in a temple. And as I got to learn more about how that building was used, it really wasn't intended to be a building that was for endowments and for baptisms for the dead and things like that. It was intended to be kind of a preparatory temple. There were obviously, you look in the Doctrine and Covenants, there were things that happened there that were critical to the restoration of the gospel. But the building was designed to accommodate that specific purpose, and it was not designed to accommodate what happened later in the restoration process. Nauvoo, on the other hand, I've not been in the building yet. We're actually going back there this summer to go through it. But the original Nauvoo building was very different from what I understand from the Kirtland Temple because it was intended to introduce the endowment and to do other things like that.
That's interesting. I remember one time I went through the St. George Temple, and I was, you know, not being an architect, only a draftsman at the time.
Right.
I was noticing that, kind of like you say, the program of it or the layout or the design criteria must have been very different because there's a lot more hallways and a lot the rooms were smaller and more compartmentalized.
Yeah.
And I noticed that right away.
Well, you see the similar thing with the Salt Lake Temple compared to one of the modern temples, the ones that have been completed recently. You know, the Salt Lake Temple, when they were doing that, there was still a procedure to going through that process where it required that there be different rooms to go to. And now the presentation is quite different, and so in a lot of cases you actually stay in the same room. So that's the program. That's where you're talking about, you know, how does the process work and what does the building need to do to accommodate the process.
Interesting. Well, this is Craig Miner, and today I'll be interviewing my brother, Curtis Miner, who is an architect, and he has a firm in Pleasant Grove called Curtis Miner Architecture. Okay, so other than church buildings, do you have a favorite, an architect or a building around the world or a couple that you feel is kind of like your, what inspires you or a favorite?
Boy, that's a difficult question because there's so many different influences in architecture that it's like asking someone, who's your favorite child, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Not that they're my children, but each one is different and each one has something to bring to the whole history of architecture. Mm. One of my favorite architects is named Robert Stern. Hmm. And he works out of New York City. He, for a time, was the dean of the Columbia School of Architecture and did a lot of work and continues to do a lot of work for Disney and a lot of other companies. And the reason I kind of latched on to him as being a favorite, I guess, is because unlike a lot of other architects who kind of function on that level of fame, that he's very well known,
mm-hmm.
he understands what it means to make a building that's comfortable to normal people, that makes sense and that's usable by normal people. Mm. A lot of times architects have a tendency to kind of go off and do things that are, I don't know, some people have called them monuments to themselves. Some they get to be kind of wacky, and in some cases that's justified. In some cases, you know, what they're doing with the building is responding very well to the program and to the client and to what the building needs to accomplish. But in other cases, it's bizarre.
Yeah.
And so in some cases, you know, we have architects that have kind of a bad reputation because no one gets it, including other architects.
And it's not comfortable and functional, probably.
Right. I mean, you go into these buildings, and it's kind of fun to visit because you can say you've been there and whatever, but to actually work and live there, it just doesn't work.
It's interesting.
Anyway, one of the things that he does really well is he has a very, very good knowledge of architectural history. You can look at his buildings, and you can immediately see connections to different historical styles, as well as just a very good understanding of just basic proportion. Proportion is part of design in anything you do. It's, you know, it works in architecture, it works in sculpture, it works in painting, it works in, you know, art that is not graphic or not three-dimensional as well. I mean, that proportion can be, you can talk about proportion in music as well,
yeah.
About how there's different sections and they need to be balanced and so forth.
That's true.
So this idea of proportion and doing something that is historically based but also very innovative in the way it solves the challenge of the building is something he's very, very good at. If you've ever been to Disney World in Florida, not, you know, the downtown Disney, mm-hmm. where you've got these little characterized buildings and they're kind of short and they're small so little people can go in them and stuff like mm-hmm. that. Those aren't his. Those are the Disney people's. But,
okay.
But if you go out to, you know, Main Street or the, I think they call it downtown Disney or something, but anyway, there are a lot of buildings out there that are, they're massive as far as the scale is concerned, but they're very comfortable to use because he's got such a good handle on historical architecture as well as proportion and being able to make these buildings fit the user and make people feel comfortable using them. And that's always been something I've aspired to try and, you know, make buildings that are innovative but still comfortable,
yeah.
that make people feel like it's kind of exciting to be there because there's a new way of doing something or a new way to look at a particular material or the way a process is completed, but they're not uncomfortable for the normal person to use.
Right. I have a unique insight into what you're saying because I've been in your house.
Yeah.
And I know that you deliberated over the design of your house and adjusted and tweaked for a solid year or more.
Yeah, that's right.
And the result is, of course, that it's everything is so thought out, and it's not a huge house. I mean, it's a good size, but the thing about your house is that it's just everything is so functional and so beautiful at the same time. I guess it's a compliment to you that you've incorporated what you're telling us about Robert Stern in the stuff that you're doing. So,
thanks.
Tell us about the creative process and maybe try and put a spiritual sort of twist on it and tell us kind of spiritually what connections are made, you know, with what you do and who you are spiritually. And maybe a two-part question. What is the creative process like spiritually speaking? And what does creating do for you spiritually?
Okay. Maybe tell a story to kind of illustrate the creative process and the connection that it has to, you know, the spiritual process. Going back to the school that we designed that was across the street from the temple, that one, there were a lot of things that happened during the design of that you really had to look at the project not through technical eyes or building code eyes or what does the city want to see or how does the parking lot work. you really had to kind of boil it down to a spiritual eyes and see what the building really needed to represent and portray and communicate to the user. And obviously that had a lot to do with its relationship to the temple across the street, but it also had a lot to do with understanding who the users were and what was important to them. And because they operate on such a spiritual level there, and that's really a big part of what they do, it was important for me in designing the building to get into that, to understand it, and spend a fair amount of time in the classrooms as they were teaching to understand how their classes worked and how they functioned, and also spend a lot of time talking with the administrators to understand what was important to them. And so as we got to understand not only the programmatic issues and the building code issues and all the other things, there was a spiritual element of that building that really came through and really is strongly communicated by a lot of the things that were done, whether it's in a subtle way to people that don't quite notice the detail or don't quite make the connection, or a very obvious way to people that do. Regardless, it's there and it's very prevalent throughout the building. And that has its foundation in a spiritual understanding of what the school is all about. Hmm. I remember when the ribbon cutting was done on the school and they did all the speeches and everything, they asked me to put together some thoughts. And as I thought back over the process and looked at the building as it was completed at the time, I remember realizing kind of for the first time that there was very much a spiritual component to this building. A lot of concepts and ideals and principles that were communicated through the design of this building that, frankly, I feel like, you know, I might have been a part of it, but more than that, I was more of a conduit to understand, you know, the relationship between what the building needed to do and communicate and how it needed to function over its life to these principles that were important to the building and its relationship to the temple. I've never really had that happen before where I feel like there's really been such a strong spiritual component to the design of a building.
So we've talked a fair amount about the spiritual component of the buildings, or that specifically that building that you worked on, the school. But in terms of your spirituality or what the creative process does for you, and you know, does it help you to live the gospel knowing that you're creative in this way, or you know, what connections are there in that regard?
Well, first off, I guess through the years there have been, you know, situations where I've kind of relied on myself, and it's not, I can't really point to one building and say that's one where I relied on myself and this is one where I didn't. But there have been, you know, as life happens, you kind of go through different phases, and there have been cases where I've kind of relied on myself to kind of run the firm and to do the design and all that type of thing. And there have been other cases and other, and this is what I try and do now, obviously, is recognize that creativity is not entirely contained within a single person. Creativity is the result of a lot of different things, and the first and foremost is that creativity is a gift from God. It's not something that I just got up one day and decided to be creative, and it's not something where I feel like there's this innate talent inside me that is independent of everyone and everything else. It's very much a process of being in tune, first off, of recognizing that the source of all good things, including creativity, is God. And having that understanding and attributing that to its proper source. And I don't know if you found that in what you do as well.
Yeah. You have to be open to inspiration. Also, you have to remain humble to stay as a conduit for what you're doing.
Right.
Otherwise, if for some reason, you know, I don't know exactly why this happens, but if you don't, then it just seems like the ideas stop flowing.
Right. And as soon as, well, in my case, as soon as I look at a building and say, well, now that is a good-looking building, and I pat myself on the back, you know, I can just guarantee that the next couple of weeks is going to be pretty ugly when it comes time to design.
That's interesting.
The other part of the question, I guess, would be, as far as what it does spiritually when you are involved in the creative process, I guess everyone's a little bit different. But for me, creativity feels like something that I'm kind of meant to do. And as you struggle and work with a project and finally get to something that you feel is the right answer, that's a very rewarding process, and it can be something that kind of helps you feel like, you know, this is one of the things in my life that I'm supposed to invest myself in and become good at. And by going through that process and completing it successfully and hopefully having a client that's happy in a building that's nice, that's something that feels like, to me anyway, it feels like it's, you're kind of fulfilling what I'm supposed to do, you know.
Interesting.
So it's a rewarding thing that way.
Yeah. Speaking of that, I wonder if you've ever been in a building or in a situation where you've just overheard somebody either praising or, I guess, dissing on a building that you've done, like, and overheard that, you know, as a bystander, and how that's made you feel?
Well, people are always really nice and complimentary of the buildings that we do, and most often what the feedback that we get is that they like the work that we do. And that's really, I mean, that's fun because, you know, people are responding to what you've done, and it seems to be a good thing that way. Mm-hmm. There's always, you always get feedbacks. You know, part of the design process in architecture is you have to put drawings together. And these drawings, particularly with the codes and things that are happening right now and all the regulatory things that we've got to meet, it's really difficult to get all of the information in the plans that needs to be there. There's never a perfect set of plans. There never has been. There never will be. Hmm. And as hard as we try, there are always deficiencies and things where, you know, maybe a subcontractor will come back and say, well, if you would have just told us to do that, then we would have done it and we wouldn't have this issue or whatever.
Right.
But as far as the way the buildings really function and that type of thing, I'm not coming up with anything where they haven't liked it.
Well, that's good. That's good. That's a good commentary on your work, I suppose.
I suppose.
I'm sure there's many, many times when you've heard, either directly or indirectly, you know, people enjoying a building that you've done. Like, particularly, I went to the open house of the Heritage School that you talked about, and I remember just all sorts of positive comments about that and people noticing all the things that you were able to implement spiritually and actually just functionally, too, like you're talking about, and it was a really cool experience. In Lehi's dream in the Book of Mormon, Lehi mentions the great and spacious building and how it has no foundation. And I know that foundations are very architecturally significant. I wonder if you could maybe shed some light on that symbolism.
Well, first off, in building design, foundations are absolutely critical. There's a whole lot more work than most people understand that goes into making sure that the soils are properly prepared, that you're dealing with the right type of soil, that the foundation is properly designed and properly installed. There are a number of buildings that we've worked on where, based on investigation, we found that the soils really aren't proper or adequate for a particular building, and so we've had to go to alternate foundation types, and some of those are very expensive. There are projects where we spend millions of dollars before you see anything come out of the ground. Huh. It's all built in the foundation. And obviously the rationale behind that is that buildings don't stand, don't do what they're supposed to do over time if there's no good foundation under them. And particularly when storms come and you've got the, you know, the wind that produces a lateral load on a building, the foundation has to be there and adequately designed so that, you know, it can resist those types of things. An earthquake, same idea. All of those forces of an earthquake eventually have to get resolved in the relationship between the foundation and the ground. That's where all the forces are going to have to dissipate. So spiritually speaking, I suppose we're a lot like that, where first off, the soil or you know, and we'll kind of make that analogous to maybe the preparation that we go through before, you know, a spiritual foundation is laid. Hmm. You have to understand what you're dealing with in terms of soil. You know, the thing that comes to mind is not everyone's soil is the same. Not every building has the same dirt that we're digging in, and not every person has the same background. You know, every person is going to be slightly different and have different life experiences and different expectations out of who they are and you know, what they're expecting out of their lives. They're also going to culturally be very different. A lot of times in preparing to build this spiritual building, so to speak, we as a people, I think, tend to kind of categorize people. We try and make them fit in the slot, you know. Hmm. And a lot of times we need to recognize that there's a lot of cultural diversity. There's a lot of different soil types, so to speak.
Yeah.
When we're working on these buildings, the best foundations come from very careful attention to detail as we're building the foundation. We've got to make sure that the rebar is properly placed, that the forms are, you know, spaced as they're designed so that we get the right footing width on the foundation system so that the loads can be properly distributed into the ground. And so I think attention to detail as the foundation is being built is critical. Spiritually, of course, that would relate to making sure that as a foundation is built for spiritual learning, that there's not, you know, sins left uncovered or sins left covered up that should be resolved, that all of those types of things are dealt with. And as we move into the higher levels of the building or the higher levels of spiritual learning, that we don't have some problem in the foundation that ultimately is going to cause the failure of the whole building.
Hmm.
And then from there, you know, you get into the building and you can make it whatever you want to make it.
Yeah. Yeah. As long as the foundation is solid, it gives you all sorts of opportunities to grow in better ways, I guess.
Yeah.
That's an interesting analogy. Thank you. I wonder, in closing, first of all, thanks so much for your time helping us with this All Things Creative program. It's been great to talk to you. I wonder if you could just close with a brief testimony of maybe about being creative and how that pertains to us.
Well, as we talked about before, I think the creative process is something that is innate in a lot, if not all, people, and it has different ways of expressing itself. In my particular case, it's expressed itself more in the field of architecture. In other cases, it'll be music, or it'll be, you know, sculpture or painting or whatever. And in probably the majority of the cases, it's not anything that can be classified as artistic at all. Or in other words, that you can go, you know, see a building or a painting or listen to music. Mm. I know that, you know, my wife, for example, is very creative in many, many ways, but she couldn't cut a straight line with scissors to save her life, you know. but she's probably one of the best people I know at just having an innate understanding of a creative way to solve a particular problem with a child, or to address a situation where the child is struggling with a particular issue, and she has just the right thing to say, and something that I never would have thought of. I mean, it's, if that's not, you know, being a conduit for, you know, a new way of solving a problem or a new approach at a situation that has been placed in front of somebody, that's what she does. Mm. And there are 100 other ways to be creative that, and not all of them, in fact, very few of them result in a piece of art or a building or a piece of music. Mm. So I think recognizing that all people are creative in their own way is an important part of actually playing the role of the architect, because, you know, architecturally, that's kind of what we're employed to do. And the expectation is that there is a building that comes out of the process. But if we go into a situation with a client, for example, thinking that we are the creative ones in the world, no one else has any good ideas, and all good we are the source of all good knowledge and ideas, that's dangerous. That's really bad. And a lot of times we will really work with clients to try and extract from them what their ideas are. In a lot of cases, they won't even know that they've got the good idea, but we'll kind of be able to pick it out and turn it into something good. Mm. So I guess fundamentally the principle is that creativity exists in a lot of different ways and a lot of different people, and the expression of that creativity in architecture or art or music is only one small way that creativity is expressed.
All right. Well, thank you again so much for being with us today. I've got one more brief question. Did you spend a lot of time playing with blocks as a kid?
No, I don't think blocks. Well, what happened? Remember, Dad had that shop downstairs?
Uh-huh.
And he had just a bunch of scrap wood, and he had a saw that, my recollection is we weren't supposed to use it, but anyway, I would take this saw, and I would cut pieces of wood up and end up with his collection of spare nails and screws, end up building things and all sorts of crazy things, and you know, sometimes it was a model airplane, sometimes it was a building, or I don't know what it was. But
Right.
But okay. Always just kind of using that pile of wood and that those screws to put things together.
The one that I remember is you emerged one day with a remote-controlled snowcraft that you made out of wood. Remember that?
Yeah.
You carved up a 2x4 or something and put an engine on it and waxed the runners. And
That actually didn't work that well.
No, it didn't. Well, again, thanks so much for being here. It's been an honor to talk to you, and I wish you the best in your endeavors.
Okay. Thanks, Craig.
You've been listening to Everything Creative, an interview between Craig Miner and Curtis Miner. For more information on Everything Creative, visit our website at radio.lds.org.